CliffCentral.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Made Sessions with Cliff Central. My name is Mbali Njomane and I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tuliza Cindy. Girl, say sup.
Hi everyone, good to be back.
We're excited to bring you part two of our podcast on raising South Africans. Our guest today is a very near and dear friend of mine. We've been friends for 13 years now, I think it is, which honestly is pretty much a lifetime to me. Actually, I feel like I've known you my whole life and it's...
Pretty much.
Yeah. You're just one of those rare people that I think I knew in past lives.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, we've been friends ever since she tried to beat me up on camp in grade 9. Very awkward because she's like quite a petite girl. And I was a bit of a largie back then. So it was quite a scene.
And then I made you spend the whole night up while I drank my med lemon and searched around for
and
something
who,
to make
who,
me feel better.
Who does that?
Having just beat you up.
But why would I do that? Like, how pathetic was that? I must have been an absolute doormat.
And then you like decided you were going to do science expo with me and then that was it. You were going to be BFFs
like,
forever.
I honestly feel like you have some power,
some
brainwashing
voodoo.
Power. I swear it was voodoo. Because I had absolutely no reason.
Do you like me or even look at me? Like, I was so gross to you. It's horrible.
I know. I've just got so much character.
Yeah, girl, the love in your heart. Hey, and now look.
I fully agree.
No. Okay, joke. Anyway, so she's here. Her name is Lerato. Say hi.
Hi, everybody.
And Lerato has a great story. Like many South Africans, her mum was a domestic worker. Sadly, she died when Lerato was just 10. And she was then adopted by her mum's employers. Anyway, I'll leave it to her to tell you the rest. But we wanted to have her here today to flip the script on part one of our podcast on raising South Africans. In part one, we spoke about domestic workers, or we spoke to a domestic worker, rather, who has helped to raise children for South African employers. She's worked for several families. And so we wanted to kind of get her perspective on parenting in South Africa, because I think it is such a crucial topic, not just for parents, but for everyone.
Absolutely.
But today we want to talk about what happens, on the other hand, when employers raise the child of a domestic worker. So, Tuliza, why do we think this is an important discussion?
So, as Mbadi said, this is literally the inverse condition of part one. And it's quite a prevalent condition in our country, and it comes through a myriad of ways. So sometimes it's from the death of parents, it's from a loss of a parent's rights to their children, which is actually quite an extensive topic in itself. Sometimes it's...
A loss of rights. Shucks.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very interesting.
And sometimes they don't... maids don't understand that they're sort of writing their children's rights
away. But
Or the rights to their children away.
How would that happen?
Sometimes it has to do with the contractual stipulations that are often not really that clear. And that's why I say it's quite an extensive topic, because these are new conditions that I'm discovering myself. But I've seen this in a couple of cases that they, you know, a parent that is a maid loses the right to their children without them knowing.
Loses the right to... To whom? To the employer?
Yeah, to the employer. So the employer,
but what would need
in
to
a
happen?
Way, has more access through rights to the maid's child than the
like,
maid herself.
What kind of, what would have to happen, you know? What kind of gross
well, one of
negligence or abuse would need to occur for that to...
Yeah, well, one of the stories actually that I read up on was something that happened in 2008. And it was a man that went to the court without the maid knowing and got custody of her twin children without her knowing.
Are you telling me that employers out here are going to court and stealing kids from domestic workers? This is a huge allegation.
It's also like in Australia when all of those Aboriginal children were just taken from their homes and just sent elsewhere because that would be a better life for you. Like, whose decision is that to make?
Yeah, and he decided to get custody of the children because
how did the court grant him custody?
He said that she drank too much and she was a bad mother.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was on that basis that he won custody without her even knowing that he went to begin with.
So here's my problem. My problem is not the man who went to go get custody. My problem is the courts and the law that allowed for that to happen without even having spoken to the mother or doing a solid background check.
Also, my thing is, it's one thing to lose rights. Like, I guess, like, I get losing rights to your kids if you're, like I said, grossly negligent or if you're abusive. And in the case of alcoholism, I absolutely understand. But there's a difference between losing rights and then losing rights to somebody. So losing custody to your employer. That's what I'm kind of, that's what's messing with me here.
Yes, I agree. It was quite a shocking thing for me to read. And
but
I'm still trying to understand.
Did he have kids? Did he want kids?
We don't know. Like, the story literally doesn't say. So I don't know. I don't know the full extent of the story, but it is a very interesting
condition. But also to an employer, which is also very distant. I feel like surely the courts need to do a background check and see if there's a relative that's closer to the child rather than an employer. That's so distant. That's a completely different life.
But I think that's actually a separate show.
Absolutely. Because this is literally why I think it is too extensive to speak about it in 10 minutes.
But it also just speaks to how interesting, vulnerable these women are, you know. And when you're that vulnerable and you have that little materially and just in terms of a voice and in terms of self-esteem, I think people can take pretty much whatever they want from
that is why the law is supposed to protect.
Exactly. Shucks. Triple yoke of oppression.
So irrespective of how weak you are in society, the law is supposed to stand for you. And the fact that it didn't, and it so easily didn't, is really quite an issue.
I mean, this whole space isn't regulated enough, you know?
Yeah.
It almost, for some reason, it just isn't on people's radar, is what I realize more and more. It's like every time I talk about a domestic worker outside of the context of their work, and if I talk about them as a human being, as a person, you know, as a full person, consummate human being, people are surprised. It's like,
yeah, you know, I also get a lot of questions that roughly say, you know, what can you get out of maids? Why would you be interested in hearing anything from them?
Sorry, can I just say something before we continue? Even to this day, the term maid in the context of a domestic worker makes me feel so profoundly uncomfortable. Every single time you say it, I literally
absolutely
cringe.
Agree with you. I've never been able to say that word, ever.
I can't do it.
I've never been able to say that word.
That's who it is.
But let me tell you, okay, so let me tell you.
And have to correct everybody that says
it. Let me tell you why we've done this. We've put it in the title. And we've changed it from M-A-I-D to M-A-D-E to try to disempower it. Because the truth is, people are going to say it. You and I might not say it, but people are going to say it.
And
if people are
going
to say something,
say
then you need to find a way to take away its power.
Well, surely you can just teach them not to say stuff like that.
Yeah, because it's like saying boy, right?
Garden
to
boy.
To a gardener.
Garden boy.
I mean,
what is that?
Also, I mean, it's strange because they refer to themselves as that. They don't use the term maid when they refer to themselves, but often they'll say, ikel, a girl. So they'll talk about, oh, you know, my friend's girl, ikel yechomiam.
Oh, wow. What? Okay. You're, being the way that I am, that would completely stump me. I'd be like, okay, the girl, and then... What girl?
Yeah, but they among themselves will talk about being girls. Dikeli, I'm a girl.
I mean, wow, that's
crazy. Yeah. Anyway, shucks. Let's.
let me just quickly wrap this up. So you've heard there's sometimes parents' rights that are lost, which is really going to be quite an interesting topic we can extend on. And sometimes it's financial incapacity, on the part of the parents as domestic workers. So if you speak to children that had this reality, which was being raised by their bosses, you'll discover that they've got very intricate social manifestations, and it sometimes stands as exaggerated reflections of what we see in greater society. So, yeah, we're going to explore this further with Lerato, as she's a product of that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you're the expert here. Mm, we're still just speculating, and we could speculate for days, but let's...
I wouldn't say I'm an expert. That's just my life. Everyone is an expert on their own life.
Seriously. And I think that, actually, this will be helpful to a lot of people.
I hope so.
Okay, so break it down for everyone, Lerato. Okay. What is your story?
So, when I was born in Petersburg Hospital, and I stayed home growing up in Petersburg and eating bup and rolling instead of crawling up until I was about 14 months old. And then I moved to Parkmore and stayed with the family, the employers of my mom. Mm-hmm. We stayed in the back room, and then we moved to Parkhurst, and then we moved to Linden when I was 10 years old. And my mother got very, very ill.
Same family?
It's a different family in Linden.
Okay.
Same family in Parkhurst, different family in Linden.
Right.
We weren't there for very long. I mean, we moved in January and my mom fell ill around March. Mm-hmm. I mean, May, April, around there. So she fell ill, and she asked her employer's son's wife at the time to look after me, you know, because she was kind of incapacitated. Right. Like, she couldn't really get out of bed or whatever. So she spent a lot of time in hospital and spent a lot of time in the homelands being looked after by her mother.
The homelands.
The homelands. The Bantustan. So, yeah. And then one day she passed away. And I found out the following day that my dad had passed away the day before as well. So essentially, they passed away on the same day.
Hold on. So you actually need to, I think, stop and explain this for people. Your parents passed away within a day of one another.
No, on the same day.
On the same day.
The very same day.
Shucks.
Yeah. You know what? It's strange because I feel like because I was bombarded by the loss, I was able to contain it a lot more than if it had been stagnated.
Is this a joint funeral we're talking about?
Yes. So a few days after the call,
my goodness,
there was a joint funeral with the two coffins next to each other in my Bantustan in Limpopo. And they're still buried next to each other to this day.
I mean, you must be so devastated at that point that, like, you're not even able to feel.
I was 10. I was completely numb. I was thinking about what I was going to wear to the funeral.
Yeah.
I was,
you can't, because so your mind numb. Cannot conceive of that. Like, my mind, as I'm sitting here, cannot conceive of that.
No.
You know?
Mm.
Your emotions, literally, I mean, because I feel like emotions genuinely do have a cap. Like, it is possible to feel too much. And I think at that point, there's a tipping point. At that point, when you're feeling too much, then you go numb.
Yeah. I remember seeing my aunt crying, and there were just no tears in me. I think I was just completely, completely broken.
My goodness,
without realizing it. Which I think, I mean, if it had happened when I was older, I would have been so much more aware and so much more heartbroken at the time, I think. Mm. So in some ways, I don't know, maybe
10
it's
is old. I remember 10 vividly.
I also remember 10.
10 is old. But anyway, okay, so what happens after the funeral?
So after the funeral, I'll go back to the people I was staying with, who then decided to adopt me. Nothing legal happened, but I was just living with them, and they were my legal guardians.
Okay. And this was on your mom's request?
This was on my mom's request. I found out very recently, actually, I found out about a month or two ago, that my mom had asked this woman who was taking care of me to take care of me, to make sure that I don't go to my family in Petersburg, and to make sure that I finish school and get a good education.
Okay, and
it's probably important to note that they were white.
Yes, that's
my
always
white parents.
That's always important, I find.
Elephant in the room.
Okay, and I mean, I don't know if you want to just touch. Look, we'll go into it.
Okay.
But basically, between now and then, if you just want to run through how your life has transpired, so
they took me out of the primary school that I was at the right. time because they didn't think it was good enough. So then I went to a private school. Then I went to the private school for 2 years and it was very expensive. And they moved properties. Then I went to a different high school, which okay, was
so basically
lovely, which is
what I'm getting
you.
To is your life completely changed overnight.
Completely.
Two different realities.
Yeah.
From that day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you expect that, or did you expect to live with one of your aunts or uncles or family members? Did you see it coming?
No, definitely didn't see it coming. A couple of days before it happened, my mom was really well. I don't know, this weird medical phenomenon that no one can explain. It's just before people die, like sometimes they get like much better.
Oh, wow.
And they're actually like able to say goodbye and everything. Mm. And then a couple of days later, they pass on. Mm. So my mom had been doing.
I saw that in Grace.
My mom had been doing really well. My mom had been doing really well, actually. So I was like super like hopeful and super excited. So when I was told, I was in complete like denial and complete like shock. Like, you know, I just didn't see it coming.
So with the, I mean, you say there were drastic changes. You were living one life the day before. The next day, all of a sudden, everything was different.
Yes.
Is there anything that they did really badly that they could have maybe done better?
So first of all, I want to tell, okay, so this is an identity crisis to me.
It's an identity crisis to every black child who was raised by white people.
if your life changes like that overnight, you can't not get confused as a person. Mm. You know,
absolutely. Who are you? What do you stand for? What are your family values? Who's your family? I was still very much exposed to my biological family as well as my white family. Mm. So it did feel like completely two different than others. Yeah. Completely two different. I mean, the one had to go to Limpopo and serve the men and cook and clean, and the other had the helper that she would chat to while she went to her private school and came home to her beautiful pre-cooked meals, you know?
Did you have a preference?
Did I have a preference?
Hmm.
My preference was parents who were alive, yes.
Oh, fair enough, straight
wow.
up.
Wow.
Fair enough. Okay, but then to your
yeah,
point.
Yeah, so what could they have done better, and in particular with the identity crisis being something so different to them and in two completely different worlds at the same time? What could they have done better to just help you integrate into both conditions?
I think I went to a lot of psychologists to help me deal with the loss, but it was very distant from them actually dealing with it. So I think had they been more involved in actually processing the loss and trying to understand the life I lived before and my
so
biological family, that would have been
really
helpful.
A
really
important
helpful.
Point, I think, okay? Because they would allow you, you know, you have two brothers.
Mm.
So you would see your brothers often because they live in Johannesburg.
Mm.
And you'd go and visit your family in Limpopo, your grandmother, occasionally. Mm. And that was something they were totally fine with and they absolutely supported it.
Absolutely.
Right? But they never went with you.
Yeah, so they were always, it always remained, my blackness was always almost at a distance, you know? Like they knew that I had my gran and my gran had her theories and I had my family and Alex, but my blackness was always at a distance. It was out of their home, you know?
You see, I would surmise that that is a big part of the identity crisis.
Absolutely.
But did they owe anything to your blackness in a way?
Well, you know, I think it was important to acknowledge, especially in the context of this country, that blackness is way more about the color of your skin. It's about your identity. It's about your culture. It's about your history. It's about your beliefs. It's about everything you've known. For 10 years of my life, I knew blackness.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, blackness was an occasional treat.
And it's a two-way street when you have a child, and parents always think about it as somehow a unilateral relationship, but it's not, right? As much as you're joining their family and you have to integrate with their life, they also have to, particularly if you had a life before them, they've got a bond with who that was.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
For the union to be consummate.
Yeah.
It's like any relationship. Two-way street.
Yeah, just so things can happen swiftly, you know. It's not like a major jump from one life to another life, but like a really smooth transition into a new life.
Yeah, and I think that's a really helpful point for a lot of parents who adopt.
But how would you guide, as a young child, how would you guide your parents into understanding that?
I don't think
that you needed that.
I don't think as a young child it was my responsibility to guide them into knowing that. However, now as an adult, I can guide the other white parents who are about to adopt black children because I don't think any child can realize that that's actually what they need. It's all fun and games to speak retrospectively, but at the time it's obviously very different.
Because I think what creates an identity crisis is a separation of worlds. Right, feeling like you have to be two people. But if they bother to get acclimated and to join with the other person that you are and the other life that you have, then there wouldn't be that crisis, you know? The two would...
You know, they actually thought they were doing something really good by sending me home and making sure that I don't forget that part of my identity. But I don't think they realized that them joining me in that part of my identity would have made me feel a lot more whole than separated, because I literally felt separated my whole life until, honestly, about 12 months ago.
Okay, and on that separated point, I'm curious about what some of your, you know, I want to give people an idea of the life on a day-to-day basis. What are some of the most awkward moments you remember growing up?
So, there was one where I was about 18, 19, where my dad, who was white, dropped me off at work in his Mercedes, and I was wearing this little dress because I was doing promotions, and everyone, you could just see that everyone thought that I was like this prostitute or whatever.
He was your blesser.
European man, that he was my blesser, absolutely. That's definitely the looks that we got. And then there was another time where I went to...
That really perverts the child-parent relationship, eh? If people look at it like that, sure.
Both of us kind of laughed it off because we actually got very used to it, because when we used to go shopping and he would pay for for me...
How awkward is that moment with your dad when you both have to acknowledge that that is what is occurring?
No, but we did it so early on because like you'd have to... We'd dine together or we'd go shopping and he'd buy me a whole lot of stuff or whatever. So we got very used to it very quickly. Like, so we just kind of giggle about it. We're just like... Just another one of those, because it happened so frequently.
Wow.
And then there was also another time where I went to school and the headmistress told me that my hair was just disheveled and I was a mess and I needed to sort it out without even asking me why.
Okay.
And the why is that black hair is different to white hair, and my mom didn't know what to do with my hair and would have to send me to a hairdresser, but I hadn't been, and so that was my situation.
The principal took the situation at face value. Did she? Yeah. Was she aware that you were adopted?
Oh, yeah.
You see, I don't know why people can't put these things together. I don't know if it's just me who thinks about that kind of thing.
What is the headmaster supposed to do?
No, she's supposed to call my mom and be like, please take this child to a black hairdresser if you can't take care of her hair yourself.
Yeah. As opposed to getting punished, right? Because she was punished for that.
Oh, wow.
And that's essentially being punished for not knowing who you are. Or not knowing how to navigate your identity.
And also because previously when my biological mother was alive, we'd spend like every Sunday evening afternoon sitting on the grass and she'd be plaiting my hair or relaxing my hair or tying it up or whatever. So I'd never really had to take charge of my own hair situation.
No, dude, you're not the only one. I think black women and hair is a, you know, another conversation.
That's
but I, you know,
a different conversation.
I still don't know how to deal with my hair. You know, I've had black parents my whole life. And
but
the struggle is real. The struggle is real.
Honey, I've got my hair under complete control.
But you had the double. You had the double whammy there, because there was the fact that your mother was white and had different hair, and so she didn't have the technique to pass on to you. And then there's just the fact that as black women, we've never learnt how to manage our hair without trying to change it.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's important because we don't know how to manage it in its natural form.
Yeah, no.
And so we do easier things like braids and weaves.
I'm about that duck life. you see, how you know I've had a bad headache is if I'm wearing a duk. And, you know, I can do it in a sensible way where it kind of makes sense. But, you know, when you see me in a duk, you must know.
Yeah, no, I had to put chemicals in my hair because I just... It's hard work, eh? Fair, and it's painful.
Fair enough.
And the memories of that Afro comb going through your hair at a young age. Yeah.
And then sometimes it breaks, girl. Exactly. What must happen?
Exactly. And then there's that plastic one. And then there's that metal one with the hand. And you're not really sure which one is actually going to be kinder to you.
Though. It looks like some kind of like...
Fierce.
Torture tool.
With the hand. Why must you have a hand there?
It's a weapon. It's a weapon of destruction. Nothing tormented me like that hand.
No, that
hand. And those metal spikes. Yeah, I'm what is happening here? Okay.
It's so interesting because, I mean, my mother made sure that every opportunity she had, she would relax my hair because she did not have time for my natural hair. So I can only imagine the relationship that your white mother had with your black hair.
She probably just avoided it.
She didn't have a relationship. That's why it was
she had no relationship with your hair whatsoever.
Until she dropped me off at the hairdresser. Otherwise, it was up to me. That's why I would go to school looking so disheveled.
I just want to make this point quickly. Note to white mothers with black kids, have a relationship not just with the child, but with the child hair.
Please.
Please. Just find a friend, a black friend who understands. Find a lovely black hairdresser where you can just get their hair plaited because that's also nice and easy.
And I've seen these private school girls. I've seen these private school girls with, you know, the outfits is on point. These private school black girls, and a lot of them, particularly ones adopted who are in white families, the outfit is perfect.
The hair.
Yeah, so whenever I meet white mothers that have adopted black children, honestly, the very first thing I talk about before I even get to identity crisis is please take care of that child's hair. Like, it's horrible in terms of
power,
trying to maintain
though.
It. And also, it has so much meaning. The fact that you respect the way the child's hair is and you respect that it needs to be treated differently.
Yeah, it's true.
Also, it's an acknowledgement of the fact that you respect their culture, where they come from.
So it's actually note. I think it's also a note to black mothers to have a relationship with their daughter's hair as well.
That's true.
And so, how's your relationship with individual family members been? Like, how has
which family members?
So your father, for instance, how's your relationship been with your father, especially since you've had so many awkward moments and.
We've got to be specific when you say father, hey? Biological or adopted?
Yeah, because, okay, so Lerato does this thing, which she always has. So she always called her parents by their first names, and then on special occasions, if they were particularly nice, i.e. when they got her the first iPod, pretty much in our school.
Oh, you were that girl.
That day, he was dad, and she was mom, but... On other days, it was always their first names. And she's also always made the differentiation between mother and mom.
Oh.
Mother being something deeper, something biological.
Oh,
and
okay.
Actually, I think quite spiritual for her. And then mom being a role.
Did you ever feel like your adopted parents filled the role well enough to be called...
Mother.
Father.
They never got there, not once.
That's completely why they didn't even get called mom or dad. They got called by their names because they provided me with things. I was handed many things. I wore them beautiful Aka Joe jerseys. I went to the right schools. I had my iPod. But that feeling of being parented was never there.
And that's really the difference, I think, between sending your child to Limpopo to visit their gran and going with them. It's that spiritual difference.
Yes.
You know? Mm. And I think... And I'm glad that you mentioned it because I think... I don't think they're unworthy of that title at all. Simply by virtue of the fact that they didn't give birth to her. But I think that title is earnable and it's earned.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's also... The very tricky thing with my adoptive situation is the fact that they didn't necessarily want children. The thing is, with a lot of white families who adopt black children, really, really want children of their own.
Yeah, they weren't ready for it.
And can't have children of their own. Mm. Whereas with my adoptive parents, they had no desire to have any children at all. And then I was kind of thrust on them.
An interesting
turn. This, like, messed up, mourning black kid, you know?
And an interesting turn of events after they decided that they couldn't handle you. And we'll talk a lot more about your space, your headspace. An interesting turn of events is they both ended up with families, with kids.
They divorced, by the way.
They're divorced. They got divorced. They each ended up with their own families, with kids. Younger than Lerato, who they're actively...
Actively parenting. So it's almost like I was
the
crash test.
She was the
dummy.
Crash test dummy.
How does that make you feel, though, to see that? To see what those children have that you didn't have?
So let's talk about what do those children have that you didn't have?
Yeah, that's a very different conversation.
Okay.
All right. It's not even identity crisis. Okay. I've been in therapy about that for about 4 or 5 years. It's literally the most heartbreaking thing to feel like you didn't deserve your parents' love and you had to earn it. It is literally the most heartbreaking thing to feel like, why didn't I do enough for them to love me enough like they love their current kids?
So you actually felt like you had to put in the work to get their love.
Oh, my entire life I've worked towards getting their love. Like, all I've done is work to earn their love. I've been to psychologists trying to figure out why my self-esteem is the way it is and, you know, why I feel the kind of self. Lack of self-worth.
Okay, but anyway, she asked you earlier about your relationship with your father. I want to know in general with, or your dad rather, your adopted dad. Mm. I want to know in general your relationship with, how has that relationship been with, how were you received by both them and by the extended family, obviously?
So I've known them my whole life, since I was born. Like, I had a relationship with all of them my entire life. I was a flower girl at each one of their weddings. Mm-hmm. I'd known them my whole life. So they were all very welcoming, very kind, very decent. But also, I think it's important to remember that this was 17 years ago. This was very, very, very new and very, very, very rare. So everyone kind of thought they were doing the best they can until they learned that they were not doing the best that they could.
Right.
And now they're applying what they couldn't apply then.
But even with all of this effort, you always felt out. Even with your extended family.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, your adopted cousins.
Completely out of place. I craved
your peers, essentially.
Craved what my adoptive cousins had. I also craved what my biological family had. Like, I was in limbo. I wasn't necessarily a part of either and fully accepted by either. So just being in limbo was just...
Talk to your relationship with your biological family.
So I, like you said, was the first kid that got an iPod. Like, so I was surrounded by so many opportunities.
Did you take it to Limpopo? Girl, that iPod, I never asked you this question. Did you take that thing to the homelands?
I think I did, but it was also new. MP3 players were also new at that stage. Mm. They literally would just come out of the era of CD Walkmans. Mm. So
how would they receive you after you had this makeover? And I want to call it a makeover because I feel like that's what happened. You got adopted, you got made over. And then you were sent back.
It wasn't actually a makeover because the person that I am has actually been pretty consistent. But it's the things that I had that were different, right? And so I would go there, let's say, for example, with like my MacBook Air because I knew I'd want to watch series at some point.
Girl.
And it would be like, what?
In the
earth?
Homelands, you would take your MacBook to
No,
them.
But anybody got time for that? Yes. Oh, wow. I do the same thing.
The thing is, though, I don't want them to feel like I'm keeping a part of me
exactly.
A secret.
Exactly.
It is what it is. It is how it is. And I will do everything that I can potentially do for you from a financial and a monetary point of view, but I'm not going to hide what I have.
But did they treat you differently because of those things that you were bringing?
Yeah. Not just that. That and the fact that I'd like bring my own groceries.
I mean, I can only imagine how bad it was for her because for me, visiting Kunu pretty much twice a year, at least twice a year when I was younger, to see my grandmother and a lot of my cousins that she was raising. I by virtue of being from Joburg and speaking the way I do, was actually called Mlungu. You know?
Wow.
A white person. And I mean, I came with a black mom and a black dad who was actually from there. But still, just because of what we had, and also, I mean, the way that I spoke, you know? And you can't... I hate when people say you speak well, because I appreciate it to some extent. I mean, depending on where it's coming from. Look, the sentiment of you speak a language well can be a nice sentiment. It's just not always coming from the right place, right? But the other thing that people don't think about is, like, the opportunity cost for me of speaking English so well is that I'm not speaking Xhosa the way that I used to when I was much younger. And that's a fact. And when you are insecure to open your mouth, because you feel like your English accent might come through your Xhosa accent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? When you speak to your grandmother.
Yeah.
I mean, I am a very quiet version of myself when I'm there.
Yeah, and the way it separates you actually from your family, because you're timid about the conversation.
Yeah.
And so you don't have as genuine a conversation as you otherwise would.
Not with me. There's nothing remotely timid about me. So I just go like head on. I will speak about like my Asian boyfriend. I will speak about how I want to adopt a kid. I will speak about all of the things
that
I want to do.
She ain't got time for that.
And my grandmother still loves me. You know, and she allows me to sleep in instead of waking up at like 6 o'clock in the morning to sweep. Like, I'm treated I'm treated particularly well when I go there. I'm actually treated like a guest rather than part of the family, and because they will let me get away with things like not cooking.
That's the
not
other sweeping, thing. Oh, okay, so it does have its advantages. And shucks, I keep calling her Tandi because that's just my kind of pet name for her, because Lerato means love and Tandi's the other one. So I've always just been the one to call her that. So forgive me if you get confused. But yes, you get, there is special treatment.
Oh,
you know?
The most special treatment.
You write it. I feel bad about
people
it.
People come to visit from so far away to see me. There's like such happy, happy glory when I'm there. More so than my brothers. Like, my grand's like, when's Tandi coming? Like, my brother, she's like, shit, fine, whatever.
But does it make you feel welcome, or does it still make you feel separate from them if they're giving you special treatment?
No, it makes me feel welcome, because I know that the reason she's giving me special treatment is because she's not 100%. Yeah, from love and, like, trying to accommodate me and the way that I've been. I mean, the mere fact that she accepted my Asian boyfriend and was like, that's okay.
Oh, and we'll get there. We'll get to that Asian guy. We'll get there. No, and also the thing that I appreciate about those people and their way of life is that nothing is that deep, you know? So, like, they'll see you. Yeah. They'll diss you. Look at you, you're fat. look at you, you're... complexion has changed. You're so much darker.
And then that's it.
You know,
everything is
ha,
fine.
Ha.
It's
not deep.
Everyone,
it's not
you know?
Deep. And which makes the love real, because all of the disses are temporary and they're not contemplated.
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely. And yeah, you can just feel the love, and you can feel that they're very much accommodating once they've made like their first point that you're very white or whatever. But it also comes from such a good place.
So let's run through this quickly, actually.
Yeah.
What I want to know from you, in your unique position,
yes,
is your interactions and your relationships with four different groups. Okay.
Okay.
I want to know what have been in your unique position. What have been your interactions and your relationships with black women? How do you feel around black women, rather, is what I should be asking.
So I think there's two things there. The way that I feel with black women who are older and are mothers, it's almost like a feeling of nostalgia and so much respect. Like, I would never smoke in front of my friend's black mother, but in front of my friend's white mother, maybe. You know, like, there's this utmost respect, right, and this nostalgia and almost this desire to be held by them.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, wow. No, very much, wow, so. It's just this desire to just be held by them. Just
I mean, my mom's available.
And your mom does that with me relatively often. And it's uncomfortable at first because I'm not used to it, but then I just get so into it and I love it so much, that feeling. And it just feels so genuine, you know?
Okay.
And with younger black women, like around my age, it's very difficult to be accepted because obviously this word coconut, everyone loves it. And, you know, everyone just assumes that that's what you are. But people are really starting to open their minds to people who have had different experiences. And because so many black women have been to private school, I'm not an anomaly with my accent. I mean, all three of us here have the same accent. I mean, I did, when I was younger, I did try to, like, you know, be more black, and I'd go visit my friend in Snawane and we'd play skipping. And there's this one skipping game where you have to name the months of the year.
Oh, girl, the month of the year.
Exactly.
Calendar 2000s.
Exactly.
And January.
You cannot
February.
Say, you cannot
March.
Say it like, the months of the year, calendar 2000, January, February. You cannot,
absolutely,
you cannot say it like
not.
That.
Absolutely.
You
are
so
disqualified.
You throw yourself right in there and you say the months of the year, no matter where you come
preach.
From.
Preach, girl, preach.
So there were certain things like that where you just like immerse yourself in the culture as it is. And, you know, people would be surprisingly quite accepting. Like those girls in Snawane that I played with on the streets, like, would be, you know, quite accepting and try to be quite understanding. So there's actually quite a big disjuncture there.
Okay. And black let's men. Talk about black men.
Black men, I am terrified of.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. I'm terrified because they are the most...
Men and boys. Okay.
Men.
Men, okay. Older men, right.
Older men. Because they are the most blatantly racist... and blatantly not understanding or not forgiving.
Yes, people, black men can be racist.
Mm-hmm. Because they're not understanding the choices. So when I was with this Asian guy that I keep mentioning, we get like really horrible looks, and black men would say like really horrible stuff to us, and I'd get stopped by the police and I'd tell my boyfriend not to hold my hand because... you know, I'm really scared
see,
of having this interracial
hatred.
Relationship.
That's hatred.
Yeah. And it was a lot of that. Like, you're taking our men and they'd walk past and be like, Sisi Wenzani with this
but
guy.
It's hatred.
Yeah. They'd be like, oh, Sisi Wenzani, Nalom China, Wenzani.
Wenzani, Nalom China.
Like, there'd be so many questions. They'd be like, how is Sisi Wenzani? Like, all the time. Like, in an angry way. Not like a confused, I'm intrigued to find out how this is happening way. Like a legitimately angry way. So but black men scare me.
I'm just not convinced if it's hatred. That's my own opinion.
It's jealousy, I mean, it's essentially.
But I mean, it's
but
founded on
comes
quite
from,
an extensive
yeah.
No,
history.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. But hatred can be reactive. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think it's hatred. I think, you know, like when you're so used to as a black man, just... being made to feel like you are the least desirable thing, you are the most dangerous idea of anything in society, it's very difficult to see a black woman going for something else because in a way it reinforces those narratives.
I
so it's not necessarily
but you can,
hatred.
I don't
it's not necessarily hatred, but it can be just frustration with a perpetuation of lies.
I don't
I
agree
think
with
that you can,
because of the access that black men have to black women to white women who actually are more open-minded than white men. They have access to women. They just have a sense, I believe, of entitlement where you belong to us.
Also, hatred... Interesting. Hatred, it is territorial, and we can't take the misogyny out of it. You know what I mean? We've got to accommodate and understand, but we've also got to be fair.
Mm.
Right? So
but
we can't
that, but that's why I think it's important to not just call it hatred.
No, let's not just call it hatred. Yeah. But also hatred can come out of if somebody kills your cat. Because I don't want to get too heavy with it. But actually that is heavy for a lot of people. If somebody kills your cat, you can hate them. It's a hatred. It's a reactive hatred,
mm-hmm.
but it's still a hatred.
I believe in reactive hatred. I just don't think that that is hatred.
Okay.
I think with black men, considering the history of this country, there is so much innate anger in them. Even if you're born as the most gentle, loving soul as a black man, anger develops.
But
you become
anger,
angry because you don't have access to certain things.
No, that's
You've been
fine.
Deprived
but anger
certain
is
things.
Not hatred.
No, but anger can become hatred when you start to make threats.
Mm.
And you know, when you can sense it though. Like, I'm not a not observant person. Like, I'm very aware of what is going on.
Mm.
And I am aware of the look that you've just given me that says to me, I'm gonna fuck up your boyfriend if I catch him alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the policeman that are like, what on earth is this? This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, and I have to be like, no, he's just taking me home. Literally, there is fear in me as a black woman who's lived in this country my whole life. That is hatred. That kind of fear can only come from hatred or jealousy.
I would tend to agree. And on that note, let's end part one of this conversation and resume shortly.
Cliff Central.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
Hi there, and welcome back to part two of our conversation with Lerato on raising South Africans. So we ended there on quite a heated note.
Mm, absolutely.
With the hatred question.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a black man question that turned into hatred.
Hey, it's that black man question at your...
It kind of escalated.
Yo. It gets deep.
But you know what? The black younger men are so accepting and so decent about it. They have so much more understanding.
Younger men, okay, we need to categorize.
So now I'm talking my peers.
Your
right?
peers.
So I'm differentiating between older people and my peers and the feelings that they generate.
Your peers.
In
so
me.
Are we talking now like middle class?
No, actually, we're talking quite a few classes. Like, people are a lot more understanding of, you know, seeing a black girl with a guy of a different race or themselves going for a girl of a different race. Like, I found that people have been a lot more understanding and a lot less hateful.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, in the slightly lower LSM, there's still a bit of anger. And I think that stems from a history of violence and anger within this country. So, my peers are very much accepting.
Okay, and so give us an example. I mean, by accepting, you mean it doesn't bother them?
No.
They don't think about it?
I know, of course they think about it. Everybody thinks about it, no matter how
Or is it that they might think about it, but they just don't say it, or they don't express it in violence and anger?
I think they definitely think about it, but I don't think it bothers them the way it bothers older black males. Like, I don't think they're as perturbed.
But you always talk about this fascination that men have with this condition.
Yes.
Do you want to talk more to that?
So, I feel like the black men are fascinated by this black woman who kind of seems white but isn't actually white but kind of knows all of these things, but they will never want to take me home because of my whiteness.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so there, you see, I was struggling with this acceptance thing.
But take you home as in
and
taking
you've nailed
you
it on
to
the head.
The family, taking you
taking
to their
family.
Family
to
you've nailed
them,
it on the head. So, what kind of acceptance is that?
Yeah, no, it's true.
It's acceptance at face value.
Mm.
Is it in a way an exoticizing of your condition?
It's like that nice thing that I find fascinating. I'm going to try it. It's like, I don't know, it's like pina colada. You're not going to drink pina coladas all night. Like, you're not going to commit to pina coladas, but you really do enjoy the taste.
I don't feel that you're a pina colada, so we might have to find a different example.
Pina coladas are so delicious, though.
They are, though. Aren't they? It could be a pina colada.
Thank you.
At least you're not a cosmopolitan.
Oh, no.
Okay, so let's move on.
White women.
Mm-hmm. Mm. White women, yes.
Yeah.
So, with white women, I have a bit of a strange relationship. Obviously, because I was raised by a white woman, but she was never particularly maternal.
So are we talking white older women now?
Older women.
Yeah.
So she wasn't particularly maternal. So I don't get a very maternal sense from older white women at all.
Okay. So that relationship's a bit estranged.
Completely.
Okay.
With most white women. And then, but with my white peers, I feel so strangely accepted, but accepted in that I'm almost like the jester. Like, oh, we don't know anyone who's black who's like you, so we really want you in our group.
It's like a Barbie doll.
Like, exactly. Like a toy.
You're a Barbie doll for...
You're not like any other black person.
White girls.
Look at you. You're not like any other black person. And we all feel like we're the same, and they accept me until it's time to suntan, until it's time to blow dry your hair.
You know what it is? I'm serious. It's like black Barbie. It's what I imagine black Barbie would be, right? When she joins the gang.
Yeah.
Of white Barbies.
Do you know how to act white or act black? So do you?
I know what I need to do in certain situations to come across as a certain way. Unfortunately, that's something learned. I know what I got to do.
Wow.
Okay.
How do you feel?
Wait, having said that, the blackness that comes from me is very much authentic. When I hear Big Nas, I want to dance. When I hear Kings of the Weekend, I am on that dance floor, tongue out, everything.
But do you do it in front of the white girls?
It is what it is. I've like become recently, very recently, I wouldn't have been able to do it before. I mean, before it would have been like, Stacey's mom, it's got it going on.
you know those deep ones, eh?
Yeah.
I don't even know those ones.
Yeah,
no, I know teenage dirtbag baby.
Stacey's mom.
You know about Stacey's mom?
Has got it going on.
Wow.
It's all I want. And I've waited for so long. Stacey's mom.
You never cease to surprise me, okay?
So before it was that, but now that I've come into my own so much more, I've very much not just accepted my blackness, but I've like really enjoyed it, and I've like kind of cocooned myself in it. It feels so nice and warm and natural. And so when I hear "Bibiya Mwajelwa," what's up, Mwajelwa? You see me tongue out.
Even that is
dancing.
A deep one. Even dancing. On both extremes, you know the deep ones. I'm clearly like a mother.
You really commit. If you're white, you are white. If you're black, you are black. That's wonderful.
Deeper. Hey. Do that thing again.
One thing.
Sing that song.
BBM Mwajelwa. What's up, Mwajelwa? Facebook Mwajelwa.
Goodness.
Twitter,
she makes a face.
Yeah, there's
and
gotta
the moves.
Be a face. There's gotta be a face, and there's gotta be some movement, guys. The aim is to sweat when it comes to black dancing.
I will say that your flexibility, your adaptability has always been something I've envied. It's remarkable to be able to go from one extreme to another. I do it because I kind of sit on the fence in the middle, you know? So I can kind of swing both ways. I'm that guy. But you can literally run from one end to the other, and I think that's a remarkable quality that's come out of your situation, that really works for you, man. It really, really, really works for you, because sometimes you make me feel really black because you're acting that white, and then sometimes you make me feel really white because you're acting that black. So that's absolutely, I mean, shucks, that's absolutely phenomenal. Okay, and last,
but not least.
Mm-hmm. White men.
So, white men, I'm going to categorize into one, because to be honest with you, there hasn't been sufficient evolution from the older white man to the younger man. So, white men, I'm just going to categorize.
Hold on. Okay, so initially, even I wasn't categorizing. I was just doing a blanket black woman.
Yeah.
And you differentiated between an older black woman and a young black woman because it's a different relationship. Yes. Are you saying now
that
this
is not
category does not warrant a separation because it is the same?
And they're not sufficiently different.
Please expand on that.
White, older white men, whether they've passed it down to their sons, whether their sons have learned it from I don't know where, but they're the same. I feel like my peers who are white men are very similar to their fathers.
I feel
like there isn't that much of a gap, that much growth, or that much evolution from generation to generation.
Goodness, that is such
an
astute
observation. They're almost the same.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's I think it comes from the same place, kind of, that the black violence comes from. Mm. I think it comes from hanging on to something,
yes,
and not wanting to let it go.
That's exactly.
Whereas the difference between black men and older black men and younger black men is that the level of education and the number of opportunities has changed much more, so they've been able to open their minds a lot more. But with white men, it's been consistently available.
So you think white men
an entitlement. Like, I want to hold on to my culture. I want to, like, hold on to, you know, this whiteness that I have as a family, and I'm going to emphasize this whiteness, you know, to my white son. Like, there's just, like, holding on to.
So do you find white men very self-preserving?
The white man culture is very self-preserving.
So that's what, yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to say was, I think white men haven't changed because they have the most to lose from big changes in the system.
Mm.
And the most to gain from the status quo.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm, absolutely.
And in my opinion, if ever there was an Illuminati, it's just, it's white male privilege. And the crazy thing is, you don't have to join it to be a part of it. You just are by virtue of your race.
Yeah, yeah.
And your gender.
No, no, you're just accepted. I read this insane article about this place called Oranjeville. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have heard of it.
Isn't it just Oranje?
I thought it was Oranjeville. It might be just Oranje. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's insane. It's actually insane. It's like Danefern on steroids for, like, very Afrikaans people. Like, you've got to be interviewed. Like, how much of your heritage do you carry with you on a daily basis to become a part of it? Like, they've got their post office.
Oh, wow.
They've got their own currency. They've got their
let's
own
stop
everything.
Taking it. Let's keep it chill with the Illuminati. Hey? It's closer to home than we think. It's white male privilege for real. But on the other hand, like, I'm empathic because, and bear with me,
oh,
I'm empathic.
She's gonna say something controversial.
I'm not gonna say something. Yeah, I don't think it's controversial. You might, because I've met white men who genuinely stand for social justice. And who don't want a dividend of white privilege, but simply don't have a choice. And like I said, bear with me, right? Because I feel like I can relate as a young black woman in South Africa if we talk about the BE framework, okay? Often I've wondered if I am afforded an opportunity because I'm a young black female because of my demographic.
Yeah.
Or if I'm genuinely deserving. Right? And look, maybe it's early for the statement because I think black women have the most catching up to do.
I mean, considering where this show, what this show is based on, they absolutely do.
And we genuinely deserve a leg up, right?
Yes.
But I'm just saying, from a personal point of view, I'm not speaking by any means for all black women, but I'm saying from a personal point of view, that's something that I've always wondered, that's always haunted me when I get any job, if I'm meeting a quota.
I know quite a few people who feel like this, and I just have a quick question. Why do you care?
Because I want to know that I'm good.
You need to know that within yourself. It's not for the employer to tell you that, though. You need to know that for yourself. And if you know that for yourself, you won't question it from the employer's point of view.
I agree with what you're saying, half. But I think when you create and you're right and you write for an audience, and it's very much about a reach, right? What I do is very much about a response, because I'm trying to communicate.
Okay.
Then I do need to know that the response that I'm getting is for a legitimate reason.
So I suppose different fields.
It's different for different fields. But anyway, the point that I'm making is, I feel like for white men, this has essentially been forever. And I'm sure it doesn't bother most of them, right? Because they own the world. And when you own the world, that's a hell of a soft landing.
Yeah.
It's like a cushion and a half, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like not so bad. A trade-off. Flip. Like, knowing you're good versus owning the world. You know, it's like, I don't know. I think for most people it's thoughtless. For me it isn't. But I think for most people it's thoughtless. But yeah, I just wanted
I wanted to put that out there.
You know, actually, that statement makes me think that that might be why a lot of white men are tormented, because the idea that everything that they have, in a way, earned, in inverted commas, is founded on a huge leg up.
It was written in stone.
And so how can they really understand, their own value by virtue of their actual hard work?
I absolutely, absolutely agree. And you meet a lot of people, I mean, white guys in particular, I think, get a lot of slack for not wanting to change the world, not being that aspirational, just, you know, living on their trust funds, living on the privilege that they have, you know, not being that open-minded, not reaching, right?
Also, I don't think they give a shit.
No, I don't think they give a shit.
Because they've got their trust funds.
No, but I think for the ones who do give a shit, I'm talking about the ones who do give a shit. For the ones who do give a shit,
is it that a must genuine
be really
shit?
That must be a really whack. Yes, it is a genuine shit.
I feel like everyone gives a shit. Actually,
it is a genuine shit. It's just, look, it's been normalized, right? So you grow numb to it, you know. But I think if you actually think about the human condition, and you think about Maslow's hierarchy, and you think at the top of that thing is self-actualization, it's not just about things.
Yes, exactly.
It's about esteem, and I think their pre-earned or predetermined rather esteem robs them of a lot of growth.
Yeah.
I know you're very close to your former domestic worker.
Mm.
And similarly, her mom died when she was young.
Mm.
But on the other hand, she became a domestic worker herself.
Mm, mm.
Do you ever think about having ended up in her situation?
I don't, because my mom knew that I was never going to be a domestic worker. My mom had really grand plans for me, even if grand means finishing your matric and, you know, getting a decent job. I knew for a fact that my mom would never, ever have let me be a domestic worker. So whether she passed away, whether she was still alive, I would have never had to fill the role that she had filled as a domestic worker.
You see, that's interesting, because that speaks to character, right? Because I think a lot of people blanket domestic workers into these people who are stuck where they are. You know, and for a lot of people, I think if you're born to a domestic worker, it is assumed that you won't have that much social mobility.
Yeah.
You know, you're likely not to make that much of yourself.
That's so strange, because I know so many people born to domestic workers who are doing the most impressive and profound
and that's
things,
something we need to cover.
But most amazing things. But like, phenomenal.
Do they also feel like they started out behind, you know, and have had to do some catching up
there has to be catching up that needs to be done.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that catching up is necessarily a monetary thing or anything. Yeah. It's a mind thing.
Yes.
It's a open my mind to the new possibilities that I could possibly have. And I think a lot of people have had to do that kind of catching up, where like, actually, my mom was a domestic worker, but I can be a CA and I can support her at some stage. Mm. You know, I think for a lot of people, this is such a sad reality, but I think for a lot of people, dreaming and hoping and having ambitions is a luxury, because you've got to do what you've got to do at the time and make do with what you have.
So, interesting question is, how must it feel? How do you think it feels for a mother essentially to not want her daughter to be what she is? That must be...
I think it's a very... You phrase it like it's negative, but I think it's a very positive feeling. I think a good mother wants more for their child, whether it's domestic work, no matter what it is, a good mother is always going to want more for their child, you know? So in this particular context, I think, I don't know, for me, I would imagine there's a sense of pride, of pride that you know that your child can potentially be something, your child can potentially do something that you weren't able to do and that your child has more opportunities. You know, I would imagine that would fill the parent with pride rather than...
And I suppose it is based, it's based more on opportunity than on character, right? So you're not wanting a different person for your child. You're wanting a different life.
Exactly. And as long as the characteristics, I mean, stay the same. Like with my mom, you know, she wanted me to be kind and compassionate and, you know, open-minded and all of these wonderful character traits. But she also wanted me not to ever be a domestic worker, you know. But the most fundamental things that she would have wanted are those character traits to stay the same.
So the other thing, though, is although the lady who was your domestic worker ended up taking over from her mom because her mom passed away as well, she wasn't ever estranged from her identity like you were. And given the fact that she hasn't had nearly as much privilege and opportunity as you, do you still envy her possibly for retaining that sense of identity? So essentially, I'm asking what the trade-off is. What would you take this trade-off between identity and privilege? What would you choose?
I mean, I think it's a very bleak world in which people would have to choose.
It was your world in a way.
So let me say this. I think people expect you to be... I think people think it was an amazing stroke of luck. You're an exception to the rule.
Yeah, you're right.
And so take what you got and be happy with it. And this actually now is a bit like what I was saying about white male privilege, is that it doesn't come with everything.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do.
From
I
an
do.
Identity point of view, it doesn't come with everything. If you are a white guy, people expect that, you know,
You're fine. Nothing's
wrong
with you.
Take what you have, what you got, and be happy with it.
It's true. It's actually true.
But are you happy with it?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, in an ideal world, my parents would be alive and it would be, you know, happy families. Even if we're poor families, we're happy families. I'd rather have a solid identity than privilege.
I mean,
having said that, a solid identity is not necessarily something I would have created for myself if I had stayed in my space. If I had been taken in by my gran, that identity would have been a manifestation of Bantustan life and apartheid living all of that. So I think identity is something that you very much have to create, for yourself. So, and I think the mixture of privilege and not privilege and fighting through this identity crisis has forced me to have a completely separate identity to anyone that I know. Thankfully, I've lived through it in many times where I could have not. Yeah, I don't know about the choosing. And in terms of envying her, I envy her ability to buck up. Like, shit, my mom's passed away. Now I've got to be a mother. I've got to be a sister. I've got to be a caregiver. I've got to be a breadwinner. I've got to be everything. Like, that ability to just, bam, your life completely changes from you being a child to being a complete adult. To be able to adapt to that is absolutely phenomenal. Having said that, I find it really sad that she did have to do that because she's young. She's little. She's younger than me. And I feel like I just wanted to have a life.
You think this work, you think domestic work takes away your youth?
No, but I think having to be...
No, you don't think so.
Domestic work takes away your youth? No, but I think the responsibility that comes with taking care of people does.
Okay.
And so she was just a domestic worker because she can.
Yeah.
She's saving up money, maybe to get a car, looking for, I don't know, whatever. And that's very different to the fact that you're in domestic work because you've got to feed your little sister you've got to feed your family.
I would surmise that it ages you with time. Slowly.
I think it's the responsibility, excuse me. I don't think it's the...
excuse the me, for what?
Did you burp?
I burped.
Yes. I wish you'd done it louder. I'm determined to master the Gareth burp. So next time, feel free.
Okay. I don't think it's the work so much as why you're doing the work and the desperation required to be actually able to do the work.
Did you think they felt guilty for not being able to relate to your Black identity and in a way help you build that identity? Was there guilt surrounding that?
I definitely don't think there was guilt. I think they just thought that I was sufficiently malleable that it didn't affect me. I mean, I was having a discussion with my mother and my psychologist the other day, and I was saying, you know, this identity crisis is so real. And she's like, wow, I didn't realize you were experiencing that because you fit in so well with all people. Like, I had no idea.
Mm. With that accent, girl, you speak so well.
Oh, she went
thank you,
there.
Thank you so much.
So well.
8-year-old white lady. You're so kind. Do you want to know what school I went to?
Older
man. White woman with the you speak so well.
One day I'm not even going to speak. I'm just going to punch it.
What is, how? How do you explain
that? I feel like that needs to be, no, the thing is, this is how it works. You need to make an example of someone. So you need to be in a very public space and you just lead with a punch. You don't even, you don't answer, yeah. You just punch. Yeah. And people will know.
We don't condone violence.
We really don't condone violence. We condone education. I can say all of this stuff. Like, I have all of these many opinions about, like, white privilege and white guilt and white people and stuff. But come crunch time, I can't negate the fact that they're my family.
Absolutely.
And I cannot negate the fact that they stepped up and took very, very good care of me and that they provided me with everything that
but
I needed.
I can't
take away from the heroes, actually, that they were in that situation.
Yeah. But
not just for me, but for my mother, who never wanted me to live a different life. Like, they did good
but
for
her. But as honest as you are with us today, can you be this honest with them?
No.
Hmm.
Also because I'd be outnumbered.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If that makes sense. The number of times you've had discussions, like, would you let your child date someone of a different race? Or how do you feel about XYZ? Like, the number of times you've had discussions where I have been outnumbered because I'm so much more open-minded.
Balance is incredibly important in a conversation.
I honestly could have this discussion with my mother. My mother's very, very... My mom is very smart and very open-minded and very real. So we'd be able to have a discussion
I think she'd really appreciate this conversation. But because we've been so hard on white people, I really want to flip the script.
Please.
Mm. We have been.
Yeah.
It's true. But let's talk about black guilt. Because it seems to me... that could be a manifestation of your situation, especially when it comes to your biological family.
I think black guilt, honestly, is more dangerous than white guilt.
What is black guilt?
Black guilt is when, I don't know if you've seen this meme on social media with this little boy who's sitting down on the sand and he's wearing Timberlands, he's wearing cute top and he's wearing cute shorts, and then his like little cousins who are not wearing very much and it's very rural are surrounding him, and it's like when you're the cousin that goes home, when you're the cousin with money that goes home. Like, it's a very real thing that many people experience. Many, many people experience it. Like, it's not just
and it must be worse people. When you're actually from a white family.
That's the thing, right? So it was very difficult for me to do things like go home with my MacBook Air. It wasn't just like, okay, chilled. It was really difficult for me to do that kind of stuff. And it was really difficult for me to know what I have that my family didn't have. Like, for a long time, I just kind of didn't engage with them because I felt so guilty. So I wouldn't let them into my life. And I kind of felt judged by them. But I realize now that I'm the one that put a strain on the relationship because I'm the one that felt really bad. You know, for example, when I went on holiday to France, I didn't tell my brothers. Mm. I didn't want them to know at all. They found out, and I felt such intrinsic and intense guilt for all of the things that I have that I know my family didn't have access to or doesn't have access to. And it's a kind of like...
I think it's going to happen here. I think that black guilt thing, if ever there was a place it would really take hold, it's here. Because we're trying to cure one extreme with another in many ways here, right? Mm. So we've created this culture of elitism among black folk, right? Where we're curing extreme white privilege with extreme black privilege. And that's not how you cure an extreme.
Absolutely.
You don't cure an extreme with another extreme. You cure an extreme with a balance. Mm-hmm. And so I think Einstein needs to come in here just a little bit. A problem cannot be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it.
Yeah.
And that's why you cannot cure one extreme with another. We cannot be...
so profound.
We cannot as black people afford to be exclusionary in what we're doing, because we're gonna have a disastrous situation.
Who's creating the extreme of blackness, of black wealth?
But I'm saying it's a cultural thing, even among black people, of wanting to be better
and striving
than other black people.
The dreams, the striving to be better.
And it's something we need to be careful of, because we're copying it.
And also, you know what?
But that's not the movement, though, right? Like, it's an aspect of the movement, or it's a byproduct of a greater movement, but it is not the movement.
Can I just say something really random?
But it's a powerful part of the movement, as all elite sects are, in terms of resources and opening opportunities for the mass. That's what makes it so powerful.
This is quite a hectic statement that I'm about to make, but I wanted to say, you know, during apartheid, the white government was so good at separating us, in that they separated Zulus from Xhosas, right? I feel like the same thing is happening now with Triple BEE and transformation, because you're separating from a socioeconomic point of view. So there will never ever be complete unity, because there will be those people who are those black people who are wealthier, those black people who have had more opportunities, those black people who earn more. So there'll never be true unity amongst black people, because there's always going to be this disjuncture and the separation.
Divide.
Which is weird, because I know that, like, the government thinks that they're doing the best thing they can for the people, and they are, but, like, in doing so, they're isolating a huge, huge group of black people that are never going to see the benefits of Triple BEE, that are never going to be empowered.
But at the same time, wealth must start somewhere, right? So where else, or in what other way should it have been enforced, if not in this way?
Look,
or at least what were the gaps in this?
I'm not a big socialist at all, and I agree with what you're saying, with wealth must start somewhere, but also wealth must start with the right mindset.
Exactly. Wealth can't start with greed. It can't start with entitlement.
That's why we use history. That's why we have history, to teach us, you know?
How much of our history is actually taught? You know, like, I mean, I remember in high school, I barely knew the country's history. I am teaching myself this country's history, because I think there's still quite a huge gap understanding of reality.
I think history was just taught very factually. Like, I don't think they, you know, spoke about characters or actual humans. It was just
who
very
writes history, you know, who writes those textbooks, who came up with the curriculum, et cetera, which is going to have us here all day. Literally.
It will.
But yeah, I think my biggest fear for black people and for that movement is to repeat the mistakes we've seen.
But I truly believe that the weight that we give to the wrong aspects of the right movement is excessive, because we are nullifying a lot of the great fights.
I agree with you. And I told you we're being hard on black people.
We've been hard on white people as well.
No, I'm saying, I told you that, like, the reason we haven't, I think, honed in on that was because we were talking about it from a black guilt perspective.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But there definitely are parts of the movement that we're leaving out. But I think for the purpose of black guilt, this is probably the right conversation to have. Okay, and our final question.
So, do you have any tips in terms of, like, identity preservation for any little black girl or boy that is likely to be adopted by a white family or a family that's of a different culture or race?
In terms of tips, I don't know that I'm in a position to do that, because it's literally taken me 17 years to reach an identity that I'm happy with.
But I think you can buy some other people some time, some give them some shortcuts at least.
Don't nullify your roots in an attempt to fit into another culture. Don't lose your blackness and be like, actually, no, I'm done with that. I'm not listening to Professor because actually I'm listening to, I don't know, what are they called? They sing Mbop. What are they called?
Hanson. Oh my goodness. No, don't knock Hanson. They have that one really great hit.
No, they do. Mbop. But it's not a black hit.
Right, fair enough. But it sounded like a black hit, that hit. What was that hit again? The Moon and the Stars.
Mbop.
Are we seriously?
No, it's the Moon and the Stars.
No, that's I swear, that's a different group.
Is that a different person?
The Moon and
who is that?
Stars.
Is that not Hanson?
The sky.
I don't think so.
It's not Hanson. All for one.
Shucks, my whole life I went through. Listen, because I thought A Small Miracle was performed in that song, because I thought for some reason there were these white brothers singing like black brothers, and I was like, oh my God. I was blown away. I was so touched by that. You have no idea.
It's all for one, I swear.
Oh, you just crushed my dreams. Like a single human identity. Because I thought if some white brothers can pull that off, like we can all be the same person. It's possible.
Can I tell you who is bringing us closer in terms of that? Yeah. Is Adele. That girl has been sounding black. I remember when I discovered that she was white.
No.
I was like,
The thing about Adele is she does the best of both worlds. She's been sounding black, but also white. And I mean, I love my rock and roll. You know, I love me. I really do.
Rock and roll, my girl.
I mean, I don't know. That might be a slightly outdated term. I don't know if it's called rock and roll, but, you know, maybe it's called something more cool nowadays.
It stopped being called rock and roll in the 70s.
Oh, my God, I'm so whack.
My honey, you need a rewind.
I'm really whack. Let's call it Blue-Eyed Soul.
Ooh, I like that. But actually, I want to ask you, Lerato, because that is such a difficult thing to do, to not put aside your identity in the presence of another very strong and overpowering identity. But how do you do that as a child? Or how do you know to do that even?
You listen to this podcast. Hashtag just saying.
You don't as a child. As a child, you do what you can to fit in and for your life to be as seamless as possible. Mm. It's the difficulty when you become an adult and then you've got to work back on excuse me. I can do this now, 17 years later, because I've struggled through it for 17 years.
But does that mean every little child has to suffer through it for those years?
Every little child is going to suffer through it until they're at an age where they can identify their own identity. You know, I know of like several adopted kids where the identity stuff was so rife and they just went completely haywire. Some committed suicide. It's just this massive anomaly. So I think until you're old enough and wise enough to decide who you are and who you want to be, it's going to be very difficult to, you know, go through the culture. But I think the most important thing is to research both, to understand both, and to try live both insofar as you can.
Was there any level of guilt in you for wanting to discover your blackness when you were raised by a white family? So
there was a little bit. It almost felt like, I was going to say treason, but that seems a bit extreme. it felt like I was negating that culture by looking for mine.
Yeah.
And it felt like that for about a year. But now I'm so happy in my black culture. Like,
but also,
I'm so happy with the fact that my black culture doesn't negate my adoption. It doesn't negate the life that I've lived. It doesn't negate anything. It's just how I feel. And also by black culture, coming from the way that I speak and the things that I like and, you know, my ordering of, I don't know, sushi and preference of like Willy's, like they're still very white things. But
I'm glad that you can be honest about that stuff without feeling unblack and like you're some kind of traitor.
That's exactly the thing. Is I've come to a point where I don't feel like treason is actually correct. I don't feel like I'm being treasonous towards any black person for being the way that I am now. I'll enjoy my blackness. I'll enjoy my whiteness.
But do your parents relate to your blackness? Because I must...
They don't. They're never really exposed. They're not never really exposed to it. I don't expose them very much to it because I think it would just remind
Russian
them...
So Russian and Chips, friend? I'm pretty sure we've shared some like spikers with
your... Oh, my goodness. My mom completely loves things like Russian and Chips and black things and... You know, that kind of thing. Mm. So, yeah, there's no issue exposing them. But I do try to contain it insofar as I can.
But you're fair because you know about things like kitchen teas. I had no idea what a kitchen tea was until you told me the other day. So kitchen tea is apparently what... You explain it.
Did I really tell you the other day?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I might be the only ignorant. Look, I still call things rock and roll.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I think, I don't know. As far as I know, a kitchen tea is when you're about to get married and you have like a tea party where these women bring you things that you need for your
and
house.
And this is separate
like
from
Tupperware and
a
stuff.
Bridal shower.
This is not the bachelor party or the bridal shower.
What?
So they come and you drink tea and there's like this high tea stuff and they bring you your Tupperwares and they bring you all of the things that are going to be necessary in your wedding and then you have the naughty stuff with your younger friends.
So there's a bachelorette party, a bridal shower and a kitchen tea.
That
is just
excessive.
Very many reasons to party. That's all that's about.
Except the kitchen tea ain't no party, girl.
Oh, okay.
It's tea.
Oh, literally tea.
Literally it's
okay.
tea.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
It's not even spiked, that tea. It's just tea.
Interesting.
Wait, you can tell none of us are married.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think, you know, I think you're a chameleon in the best possible way. I think you can do both. I think you've honored both the black part of you and the white part of you, and in many ways maybe you're every man.
But I think we forget how painful it is to be a chameleon.
Absolutely. But I think, and I really mean this, and I want you to actually internalize it, I think you're every man. I really do, and I think that's always been the basis of our friendship. It's always what I've aspired to and admired about you, is that I actually think you can relate. You're more relatable to people than most of us, you know? And I just want to say mad respect, sister.
Thank you. And it's been a long, hard journey. It really has. But, so,
and yeah. It actually sounds like you've had many breakthroughs very recently.
Very recently. A lot
so
of
tell us, okay,
recently.
So just to end the show, tell us your current living situation. And
so I fell ill and I was in hospital twice this year. And the second time we just decided that I need to live with someone who can take care of me. So I've lived with my brother and...
Your biological brother.
My biological brother. And my biological uncle has been there for me and my other biological brother has been there for me. And for the first time in my life, I actually understand what people feel when they talk about family. For the first time in my life, I don't feel like I have to earn love. For the first time in my life, I feel like I'm loved unconditionally. You know, not my life, but my life post being 10.
And on a family.
On a very family, you know.
Based, yeah.
I just, it's the most wonderful sensation. And I didn't know.
Do you know how to receive it?
That.
Do you know how to receive it?
So that's something I'm still struggling with. So I'm constantly like, I'm not pushing back, but I'm still constantly trying to earn it. So I'll buy this, or I'll do this for you, or I'll do that for you.
Does it then, in a way, feel full circle?
It actually does. It actually really does. I feel like my life started out a certain way and then went completely haywire, did like complete 180, and now it's amazingly turned on itself to be what it was, what I knew, what I was comfortable with, what I liked.
And
you know,
isn't that the perfect way to end a show?
Absolutely.
Because you really have taken us on this journey with you, and it's really been worthwhile, and I think it's rare to have such open and honest and insightful conversations. And
I'm so proud to be your friend. I'm so proud of the show.
I'm very honored to see the friendship. It's really amazing to see.
But just like that, you know, a conversation deals you a full circle. So thank you.
Thank you so much, so much for
being
here.
Thank you, Talitha, for your contribution, as always, is amazing. Any last words, ladies?
I just want to say thank you very, very much for having me. This is the first time that I've been able to express myself in this way in a almost public forum or a public space. And I appreciate that you guys made me feel swaddled and safe.
I don't even know what that means.
I don't know. I was about to say, like, it's rare
when you rap a baby
for me to like ask you what a word means, but I'm gonna do it.
Yeah,
it's when you wrap a baby in a blanket.
That's beautiful. I'm gonna use that all the time.
Me too. You know?
So does that make up for? Yeah, I feel like we're square now, you and I.
Yeah. So I really, I do appreciate that, and I appreciate the fact that you let me swear a little bit and burp a little bit. I
appreciate Cliff Central. That's who let you swear. That's really who made this conversation happen.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for your kind words and tools.
Thank you. Honestly, that's all I have to say. I'm taken aback. Thank you.
And just like that, done and dusted. Thank you so much for joining us today. We had fun. Hope you did and learned a lot as well. And we'll catch you later. Keep joining us on the Made Sessions with Cliff Central.
Cliff Central.
The revolution. I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.